I'm Dr. Kim Oberholzer, and I'd like to welcome you to the Grace Rock Ministry Podcast. I hope you enjoy today's lesson, and I would encourage you to visit our ministry website at www.gracerockministries.org to learn more. At the website, you'll learn more about Grace Rock and our reason for being, which is to share the gospel of Jesus Christ, to shepherd, mentor, and creatively communicate God's Word. In the meantime, sit back and relax and enjoy today's lesson. God bless. Okay, we are in 1 Kings chapter 6 tonight's where we're starting. The first few weeks we were in the first part of 1 and 2 Kings here, retracing the glory and division of the kingdom of Israel and Judah. The book opens with the death of King David as an elderly man, and the throne is transferred to his son Solomon. Although there was a dispute for the throne with Solomon's older brother Adonijah, and Adonijah is not the one that David appoints, but Solomon is. So Adonijah is removed from power, and then he rebels. He asks for David's key, well, they call her a damsel in the King James, but she's a concubine. So he asks for David's last concubine, the Shulamite woman. And that's the equivalent of saying, you're granting king's power to me. So Solomon realizes what's going on, and so he sends his soldier, head of his army, Benahidah, to go out, and Benahidah falls upon Adonijah, and he dies. So when Benahidah comes to your house, he falls upon you, you will die. So he goes and falls on Joab also, and he fell on Adonijah also. Although Abathar, the priest from the line of Eli, got away, and Zadok is now the priest. So in the lineup, we now have Solomon, Benahoida as the army general, and Nathan as the prophet of God. So that's the beginning of this dynasty that's going to start with Solomon. And so last week, we looked at Solomon asking the Lord for wisdom. And in chapter 3, God grants to him in chapter 3, verse 9, he says, please give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, to discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? And then it says, and this thing literally was pleasing. The word was pleasing in the eyes of the Lord, or God smiled. And so he grants him discernment to understand justice. Literally, he requests a hearing heart, is what the Hebrew reads. And that means the ability to know good from evil. And we talked about good and evil. It's kind of confusing today, in case you haven't figured that out. What used to be called good is now called evil, and what used to be called evil is even worse. And whatever evil was, it's not anymore. It's good. Or it's a focus group determines what's right or wrong today. So if the group says this, it's got to be this. If it's not that, it's not this. It's not this. It's not that. And I don't know, I just have a sense that the media may have something to do with that, but I'm not sure about that. So, since I'm a 501c3, I'll not make any political comments. So, chapter 6 of 1 Kings, it opens up, and Solomon has been starting to build the temple for the Lord. He had preparations in chapter 5. In chapter 6, he'll start the construction, but I want to point out a key date for you in chapter 6, verse 1. It says, now it came about in the 480th year after the sons of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord. Now, add 400, this is 967 B.C., add 480 years to what you come up with. B.C. years. 1,446 years. So the Exodus was in 1446 B.C. So some people put the date as an early date or a late date in 1250 B.C. because of the Pharisees named Ramesses. But the scriptures say that it was 480 years after the construction of the temple. Ken, would you help Sally there for a moment? Thank you. There we go.
So we know that the Exodus occurred in 1446 B.C., so that would be an early date for us. And so he begins to build the house for the Lord, and then we get construction sizes and doorways. But in verse 11 of chapter 6, the Lord once again reiterates to Solomon, the leader, the affirmation of the Davidic covenant as well as the law. Thank you, Ken. Says, now the word of the Lord came to Solomon, saying in verse 11, concerning this house which you are building, if you will walk in my statutes and execute my ordinances and keep all my commandments by walking in them, then you will carry out my word which I spoke, then I will carry out my word which I spoke to your father David, and I will dwell among the sons of Israel and will not forsake my people. So Solomon built the house and he finished it.
And he has an inner Holy of Holies, and I think I gave you a handout last week that showed a picture of some of that.
So verse 38, it says at the end of that, it was 7 years in building it. So it took him 7 years to build the temple to the Lord. Now, he's got other projects going on because he loves to build things. And remember, he conscripts labor. He uses forced labor to help him. So that doesn't make him terribly popular as a king at points. But chapter 7 opens, he says, now Solomon was building his own house 13 years, and he finished all of his house. And then he built a house of the forest of Lebanon, which was 100 cubits, and its width was 50 cubits, and its height, so it's 150 by 75 feet by 45 feet high, approximately 11,250 square feet for this particular building. So we build a house of halls in this, in verse 6, he adds the throne room in verse 7, and then we get another note. He's continuing to build things for people. In verse 8, it says, in his house where he was to live, the other court outward from the hall was the same workmanship, and he also made a house like this hall for Pharaoh's daughter whom Solomon had married.
You remember back in chapter 3, verse 1, when he came to power, one of Pharaoh's daughters was given to him, and so he built her house too.
And so we got him building houses for just about everybody. What strikes you between 7 years of building a house and 13 years of building a house? Whose house is he more interested in?
Well, that's the only. Remember, only Solomon forgot to take down the high places. Only, lest, perhaps. Oops. Cut a corner here. Oops, cut a corner there.
Well, the same thing's going to happen in latter times with Israel, too. We'll get to that when we get to Malachi, and we see him calling on the people to rebuild the temple after it's been destroyed.
He will say, is it time for you to dwell in your houses of ivory while the temple of the Lord lies in ruin?
And then he points out to them,
your pocket, he said, literally, your pockets have holes in them. Your money burns a hole in your pocket. And the reason is because inflation's caught up with the people and they're spending money on themselves instead of the Lord's business. And so there's that balance of recognizing who owns what.
So the people have kind of forgot about that in the meantime there. Verse 13 of chapter 7, King Solomon and brought Hiram from Tyre. Now this is not the king, this is an artisan. He's half Jewish and he's from Naphtali. Says he brought Hiram from Tyre. He was a widow's son from the tribe of Naphtali, so he's half Jewish. And his father was a man of Tyre and a worker in bronze. And he was filled with wisdom and understanding and skill for doing any work in bronze, so he came to King Solomon and performed all his work. So he builds this inside. He makes pillars of bronze, pomegranates of bronze, oh, hundreds of these things. He's just a very skilled craftsman. Which I think the principle here is that each of us have different gifts in the body. And
as we function together, those gifts complement one another. You're not gonna receive rewards from the Lord someday based upon what I do here. You're going to be based upon what you do with your gifts.
And I have a friend who's a Marine. He said, let's see, he did Vietnam 3 times because he loved combat. I met him in seminary. Ran 15 miles a day every morning. Kind of put a knife between his teeth and then jumped out of his car and rode, ran 15 miles. One of those kind of guys. He
was Red SEAL teams up the Mekong Delta.
He loved combat. And he said, if I hadn't become a Christian, I'd be a mercenary because I just enjoy war. And I said, you know, you're kind of sick.
I mean, I guess we need people like you on certain occasions, but you kind of scare me walking around here. He's an engineer on railroad out of Tucumcari, New Mexico, so just be careful who you tick off, because that guy can come out of that train and have you cut up to four pieces before you ever knew anything about it. But I said, how do you have the discipline to do this, you know? He said, I don't know how you have the discipline to sit down and study 5 hours straight. So I realized, different people have different kinds of gifts, and I have a teaching gift, or at least so I'm told, so I try to use it. Then others have the serving gift. But this old Marine told me, he said, for every one Marine on the front, there were 12 support people. Between cooks and medical staff and food and ammunition. To make that one, put that one soldier on the front line, there were 12 support guys. And in David's life, we're not going to see it in these books, we'd see it in Samuel. One time he has a bunch of guys stand by the baggage and guard all the stuff in the rear while they go do battle, and then when they come back from battle, the spoils are divided, and the guys in the rear get just as much as the guys who were out doing the battle, because they were back protecting the rear guard, so they'd have camels to get on and go home on. So camels were the Mercedes of the Near East, in case you didn't know. So anyway, different gifts, different things. My brother has a gift of, he can take anything apart and put it back together, and when he was in the fifth grade, Dad brought an old car and put it in the driveway and said, here, you work on this. And from the fifth grade till high school, he was out there underneath that car almost every night. He took the whole engine apart, put it back together, and by high school it was running. And he's intimidated by my, quote, scholarship abilities. That just means I persevered longer than you guys did in the basement. So he's kind of intimidated by educated people, and I'm kind of intimidated by all the stuff he does with a car, you know. He says, all these guys in suits come in with BMWs and Lexus and all these cars, and they say, we got a rattle in the door. He says, we take the door panel off, we look around, see if there's a rattle, throw a little toilet paper in, spray some fresh stuff in there, and charge them $600, and they're all happy. So, know that it's not quite as complicated as it appears at times. Not to bemoan that, but, so, anyway, that's different kinds of gifts for different kinds of things. Chapter 8, Solomon is going to dedicate the temple. Hold on, we're going to get some good stuff here in a minute. this is what he puts inside the Ark of the Covenant. Verse 6, the priest brought the Ark of the Covenant to the Lord to its place. Chapter 8, verse 6. To the inner sanctuary of the house, to the most holy place, under the wings of the cherubim. Verse 9, there was nothing in the Ark except the two tablets of stone which Moses had put there at Horeb, or Sinai, where the Lord had made a covenant with the sons of Israel, and when they came out of the land of Egypt. And it came about when the priests came from the holy place that the cloud filled the house of the Lord, so the priests could stand and minister before it. For the glory of the Lord had filled the house of the Lord. So the glory of the Lord is now back in the temple. What do you notice in verse 9 is missing from the Ark here, if you can remember what was in the Ark? Okay, Aaron's rod and the pot of manna are not here. So where are they? I don't know. That'll probably be another movie for Spielberg to make. The manna and the ark. And the rod of Aaron. So I don't know where those are. They're just not here at this particular point in time. So, Solomon, verse 22, stands before the Lord in the presence of the assembly, and he prays, O God of Israel, there's no God like you, in verse 23, in heaven above, or on earth beneath, who keeps the covenant and showing your loyal love, your chesed, your servants who walk before thee with all their heart. So he now gives this very beautiful and long prayer, which you can read at your leisure. Chapter 9, these are various buildings that Solomon's going to do. And in 9:1 it says, it came about when Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house and all that Solomon desired to do, that the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time, as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. So all the way back to the starting of his rule was at Gibeon, where he sacrificed on the altars, and the Lord showed himself there, and he gave him wisdom. And again, he's calling him, and the Lord's calling him in verse 4, as for you, if you will walk before me as your father David walked in integrity
of heart and uprightness in doing all that I have commanded you, and I will keep my ordinance and statutes. Then I will establish your throne forever.
Of course, verse 6 is, then if your sons indeed turn away from me,
from following me, and they shall not keep my commandments, my statutes, verse 7, then I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given to them, and the house which they have constructed for my name will cast out, I will cast out from my sight. So Israel will become a proverb and a byword among the peoples. And this house will become a heap of ruins. Everyone who passes will be astonished and say, why has the Lord done
this to this land and to this house? And they will say, because they forsook the Lord their God. Again, we're operating off that covenant. If Israel obeyed, she would be blessed. If she disobeyed, she would be disciplined. Now, we're trying to get this hammered in through Solomon's head here because he's a little bit slow to get it. So we get to chapter 9 about verse 15. We're going to see some more of his fortress cities here. 9:15, it says, this is the account of the forced labor which Solomon levied to build a house of the Lord, his own house, the Millo, which is part of the northern
wall in Jerusalem there.
The wall of Jerusalem, Hazor,
Megiddo, and Gezer. These are some of his fortress cities. Megiddo is also known as Tel Megiddo, where they've done archaeological digs.
Megiddo is the location. It is also called Har in the Old Testament, Har Megiddo. Har is mountain, and Megiddo is the location. And then we get in the New Testament the term what? Armageddon. So it's in the Valley of Jezreel there. I've been on there on numerous times.
It's quite an interesting place to stand and look out over that Jezreel Valley and realize it says in Revelation the blood is going to run to the horse's bits, which is 4.5 feet tall, due to hand-to-hand combat in that valley in the latter days.
And you look out over that stretch and it's miles and miles and you're just like, this is really going to be some kind of bad thing. So, good news is, if you're pre-trib, you get to go with us. If you're post-trib, you go with someone else. And if you're mid-trib, you're stuck in the middle. So, I just would stay away from that valley, that's for sure. Probably be right north of Lucanbach, Texas about that time. Down in my hole there with my guns and beans or something. You know. Verse 26, it says, Solomon also built a fleet of ships in Exon Geber, which is in the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. And near Eloth on the Red Sea, Hiram sent his servants with fleet, sailors who knew the sea with servants of Solomon, and they went to Ophir. We don't know where that is. We think it's somewhere in South Arabia. And they took 420 talents of gold from there and brought it to the king. So that's about 32,000 pounds, 16 tons of gold to the king. Now we get another one of these exotic people coming to see Solomon here. And I think her name was Elizabeth Taylor. He says, now when he saw the queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with riddles, literally riddles. Again, these are wise men of the west and wise men of the east coming to test one another. Egypt had all these wise men.
So she came to Jerusalem with a very large retinue, a great army of wealth, with camels, there we go, carrying spices and very much gold and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, she spoke with him about all that was in her heart. So she got all these questions to ask this wise man. And Solomon answered all her questions, and nothing was hidden from the king, which he did not explain to her. So when the queen of Sheba perceived all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food at his table, the seating of his servants, the attendants of his waiters and their attire and his cupbearers and the stairway by which he went up to the house of the Lord, there was no more spirit in her. In other words, Solomon outsmarted her here. So she's brilliant. We're talking about Solomon's colonnades and the courtyard there. They were magnificent and beautiful. So verse 6, she says, it was true, the report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. Nevertheless, I did not believe the reports until I came and my eyes had seen it. And behold, it was half was not told to me. You exceed in wisdom and prosperity the report which I heard. How blessed are you men, how blessed are your servants who stand before you and hear your wisdom, continually hear your wisdom. So blessed be the Lord your God who delighted to set you on the throne of Israel because he loved Israel. So she's impressed with him, and the ships of Hiram show up again in verse 11. They brought gold from Ophir. a great number of almug trees and precious stones. I don't think we know what an almug tree is. Does anybody know what an almug tree is? Some say sandalwood, but I don't know what an almug tree is. They didn't have it in Arizona, and they don't have it in Texas. It probably is something I'm not going to know. Cactus is what you got in Arizona. You only got two bugs in Arizona, snakes and scorpions. So, no cockroaches, no water bugs, nothing in between. 120 degrees gets rid of everything. Just know that if you get bit in the night, you are going to scream. So, verse 13, the king of Solomon gave the queen of Sheba all of her desire, and which she requested. Besides, he gave her according to his royal bounty. She turned and went to her own land together with her servants. Now, that's all we know about the queen of Sheba and Solomon, okay? How you make a 2.5-hour movie out of that? You got to take a little poetic license with it, okay? So Solomon has all kinds of gold, 25 tons or 50,000 pounds of gold here we see. This is verse 22. I like this. The king had at sea from the ships of Tarshish with the ships of Hiram. Once every 3 years, the ships of Tarshish came bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and peacocks.
So there's some animals
in the Bible. So how many apes were there on the ark? Who knows? But this on Solomon's boat, we have apes, plural, and we have peacocks, plural. So Solomon became greater than all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom, and all the earth was seeking the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. Isn't that something?
All this great wisdom. Now, go with me to Deuteronomy chapter 17 for a moment. Go back to the law again. I want to see what the law commands of kings, so they try to stay on the right path. Deuteronomy chapter 17. We'll pick it up with verse 14 of Deuteronomy 17. When you enter the land which the Lord gives you, and you possess it to live in it, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me. You shall surely set a king over you whom your Lord God chooses from among your countrymen. You shall set a king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman. So I guess it has to be a natural born citizen there. Moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, since the Lord has said, you shall not return that way. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest, that's that little English word lest, it's that perhaps in Hebrew, it's that one that just grabs your attention. It could be that his heart will be turned away by these wives. Nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. So he's supposed to have this copy of the law that he's read to him in his personal presence all the days of his life. So Solomon knows what the king's supposed to do
and what he's not supposed to do. And he's obviously got people coming from
all over the world to hear this guy's wisdom. This is like, well, he's like the ultimate smart guy, you know, on Jeopardy.
He's got all the wisdom and the answers for all these things.
Except when it comes to the application of it, something there's missing between knowledge and application.
Or it's just willful rebellion, knowing it. Of course, then we say, well, why? How about us? What do we willfully disobey? Well, we're in the New Testament. We're under grace. We only
willfully obey the little things. Disobey the little things, right? Except all of it's called sin. So a little thing that we perceive to be a little thing is not really a little thing. It's always a big thing. Because a little thing ends up being a big thing when it's all over.
And then by the time you start with a little thing and it ends up being a big thing, and then everything comes unglued around you and you look around and you go, how did I get here? You're wondering, how in the world did I get here so fast? Well, it started with a little thing. Almost always starts with a little thing. And so Solomon, chapter 11 opens up. He multi-loved many foreign women. Oh, did he love the women. It's like Elvis. So, well, actually probably worse than Elvis. So the daughter of Pharaoh, not to disparage the spirit of Elvis, for those of you that still think he's alive in El Paso. The daughter of Pharaoh, the Moabites and the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Sidonians, and the Hittites. Look at all those Ike women. Don't date Ike women. Ike women will get you in trouble faster than anything. They don't know the Lordeth. You want the Lordeth women. You don't want an Ike woman. So when you get the
Ammonite or a Hittite or an Amazonite or a whateverite,
you're going to end up in trouble. Notice it's from the nations, verse 2, which the Lord had said to the sons of Israel, you shall not associate with them, neither shall they associate with you, for they will surely turn your heart away after their gods. Ooh, here's a nasty little sentence. And Solomon
held fast. He, dabak is the Hebrew term, held fast to these in love. That little phrase, dabak, is used for a husband cleaving to his wife in Genesis 2. You're supposed to dabak your wife. You're supposed to cleave. Leave and cleave. You cleave to her. And it's used in the Septuagint of sticking like glue together. And the two become one. The one flesh is only used of a husband-wife relationship. It's not used of a mother and a daughter or a son and a dad, or cousins or relatives. It's something unique to the marriage covenant, the becoming of one flesh. And it's more that it includes sexual relations, but it includes
a much deeper commitment than that. That's why you always give a piece of yourself away when you do those types of things. I don't know how to get it through people's heads, and I'm not sure if Lord hadn't been merciful to me, I would have got it through mine. You don't marry an unbeliever. I don't care if you're young or you're old. It's just bad advice. But she's so wealthy, or she's so good looking. Or they'll tell you met your men, you go, oh, you're so good looking. You'll believe it. Now look in the mirror when they say that to you.
Okay? This will help slow things down a little bit, okay? And you'll go, are we talking about this same face? Look at this one. Have her look in the mirror, make sure it's your face she's thinking about. Okay?
Because you'll believe it. Oh, you're so strong. You're such a good man. Oh, look at you. Oh, you're kind. My husband isn't kind to me. He's mean. He didn't start off mean. There's a reason he got mean. Oh. And there's always two in the tango. I don't care. Every time I've had to deal with marriage counseling, it's a both and. It's not an either or. And nobody is faultless. Even in good marriages, everybody's at fault. So just face up to it. This is for guys to box you with. You're supposed to stick with it. It's hard to do sometimes. And it's hard to go the distance. And not everybody does. And sometimes you fall and you stumble and you pick yourself up. Some of you met the Lord through those experiences in life. And I'm thankful that you did. I'm glad He redeemed you. And it can be forgiven.
Divorce can certainly be forgiven, as other sins too. But it does tend to have a nasty effect on family and friends and grandparents and children.
And I know all the kids are going to be okay, right? How many times have I heard that? So Solomon knows the right thing to do.
But knowing and choosing to do the right thing are two separate things sometimes. I told you about an older pastor friend of mine, Don Geiger. Don has been a friend of mine since seminary days, way back. I haven't talked to him in years. Because I outgrew being a young pastor. I really needed him in those early years. But he had a little phrase. He said, you need to pre-decide not to sin. If you know there's an area that you're going to sin, pre-decide ahead of time that you're not going to do that. So Jan and I made an agreement. If we're going to do adultery, we promise to call each other and ask if it's okay. So we used to keep a quarter handy, but now we're on speed dial, so might move a little faster than in the early days. But he says, because if you pre-decide not to sin in a certain area, whether it be covetousness or critical attitudes or lust of any kind, that could give you the 3 to 5 seconds you need to turn away. Because if you say, that's not even an option for me, I can't do that, I've already decided I'm not going to do this. And it could save you from sin and your walk with the Lord. Save you from the discipline of the Lord, too. So Solomon holds fast. He debauched these ladies.
In verse 3, he had 700 wives,
princesses, and 300 concubines,
and his wives turned his heart away from God. So it came about when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord as his God, as the heart of David his father had been. And even David had his foibles. That is one thing about the Scriptures. The men and women of Scripture are real people. They're
not some polished up king or god that has no flaws. I mean, that tells me there's something true about this book, because if you're going to write yourself up as a divine being, you're not going to want to have flaws hang out like adultery and extra kids and those kind of things. But the Scriptures
are very real in that respect, showing us who we are. And it shows us God's grace and his redemption. That's the part I like, because that's the part I need the most. But here goes Solomon, verse 5. For Solomon went after the Ashtaroth, that's a Phoenician god of the Sidonians, and Milcom, or Molech, the detestable idol of the Ammonites. And Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord fully, as David his father had done. So Solomon, watch this, he built a high place for Chemosh, this is Moab's national god, the detestable idol of Moab, on the mountain which is east of the mountain, east of Jerusalem, for Molech, the detestable idol of Ammon. Thus he did for all his foreign wives who burned incense
and sacrificed to their gods.
It's the city of David down here at the bottom part of the hill. Up here is where the Dome of the Rock is today. This is Solomon's expansion and his palace up here. This is Kidron Valley right here. Then it turns into the Hinnom Valley running back that way. There's a central valley that runs through here and then a transversal valley that comes through this way. But right on top of this hill, just outside of this eastern gate, about 600 yards you go up here, this is the Mount of Olives. So the Holy of Holies is here where the glory of the Lord's dwelling, and 150, 250, 300 yards up this direction, we have an idol to Molech, which has arms stretched out, I think we told you about it. They put the fire under it, they heat it up, and the arms turn red, and they throw the babies on the arms, and the babies are sacrificed to the god Molech, child sacrifice. Right there on the Mount of Olives, that's where Jesus is going to ascend 1,000 years later to go to be with the Lord in glory. So we've got the glory of the Lord here, Chemosh and Sidon and all these detestable idols right there. Like that tell I showed you at Arad where you had the altar to the Canaanite gods, and then not. Let's see if I can. There it is. Some of you may have missed this. This is Tel Arad. Can't read the Hebrew. It says the Israelite temple. This is not a big area. This is a Canaanite high altar. This is where they would offer children, animals, all kinds of things on them. This is the holy place of where they would sing and do hymns. And then not 10 feet away, right here, going into here, this is the holy place where they would worship the Lord of Israel. So you have synchronistic worship. You've got pagan worship here, and 10 feet away you've got the worship of the Lord inside that area. And this is a wonderful tell if you get up there. It's kind of hard to walk up to, but it's one of the key cities of Solomon up there. Get out there in the wilderness. That's where I discovered Nokia cell phones. An Arab walked up to us, drove up to us on his camel, and the phone rang in 1990. This was long before cell phones were even anywhere. He reaches inside his turban, he starts talking on a Nokia cell phone, and we're all kind of going,
"What the heck is that?"
And we went down to the Gulf of Eilat, and that's where the French and the Germans go to play, the European playground. And in the hotel we were in, all these people had Nokia cell phones. So I bought some Nokia when I came back in 1992.
Turned out to be a pretty decent investment.
So never can tell what you're going to find wandering around the desert out there. You might find the next great stock.
It'd be a big one for you.
So this is where we end with Solomon. We get no indication that he came back to the Lord in the book of Kings or Chronicles. And so he's going to go be with his father. Let me see if I can find that. Verse 9, the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who appeared to him twice, and he didn't observe these things. So God raises up adversaries for him. Verse 14, the Lord raised up an adversary, it's literally Satan,
is the term for adversary. They're not
Satan, but just Satan. It's a term for enemy.
To Solomon, Hadad the Edomite
of the royal line in Edom. And then verse 21,
when Hadad had heard that in Egypt that David had slept with his fathers and that Joab, the commander of the army, was dead.
He wants to go back to his own country, so he comes back and he becomes a torment for Solomon.
In verse 23, God raises somebody else up to torment Solomon. It says, God raised up another adversary, Retson of Eladah, who had fled from his lord Hadad-Ezer, king of Zobah. Don't you love these names? I see grandkids' names all over the place here. Hadad-Ezer, that'd be
so cool. What a name.
Zobah. Yeah. So anyway, he gathers a major marauding band. And Jeroboam, verse 26, is going to be where we first meet this gentleman. The son of Nebat, an Ephraimite of Zeredah, Solomon's servant, whose mother's name was Zerah, a widow, rebelled against the king. Now, this was the reason why he rebelled against the king. Solomon had built the Millo, the fortified area on the north side of the city, closed up the breach at the city of his father, the city of David. Now, the man Jeroboam was a valiant warrior, and when Solomon saw the young man was industrious, he appointed him over all his forced labor over the house of Joseph.
Now, we got to pay attention, because here we come in verse 29. It came about at that time when Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem that the prophet Abijah, the Shilonite, found him on the road. Now, Ahijah had clothed himself in a new cloak. Both of them were alone in the field, and Ahijah took hold of the new cloak which was on him and tore it into 12 pieces. And he says, in 31, he says, then he said to Jeroboam, take for yourself 10 pieces, for thus says the Lord, the God of Israel,
behold, I will tear the kingdom out of the hands of Solomon and give you 10 tribes. But he will have one tribe for the sake of my servant David, for the sake of Jerusalem city, which I have chosen. Why? Because, verse 33, they have forsaken me and have worshipped the Ashtoreth, the god of the Sidonians, and Chemosh, the god of the sons of Ammon, and they have not walked in my ways, doing what is right in my sight, and observing my statutes, my ordinances, as his father David did. So, he's telling him that the kingdom is going to be split. Verse 40, Solomon sought therefore to put Jeroboam to death, but Jeroboam arose and fled to Egypt. Shishak, the king of Egypt, Shishak will later invade Israel, and he was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. So now the rest of the acts of Solomon, whatever he did, verse 41, are in his wisdom, are they not written in the book of Acts of Solomon? Thus the time of Solomon reigned over all Israel was 40 years. So some have suggested he was 52 when he died, some maybe a little bit older. Not positive. We get the 40-year reign, but we don't have a start date for him. So 43, Solomon slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of his father David, and his son Rehoboam ruled in his place.
Go with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 19. It's to the right there, right after Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is certainly written later in life by Solomon, and it seems like an older gentleman reflecting on life and what really matters. So some have suggested maybe he returned to the Lord, but again, we don't have any historical narrative for that effect.
So Ecclesiastes chapter 2, I will pick it up in verse 18 because he's making observations.
You know, you work and you work and you work all your life. And some of you have worked longer and some of you work less, but most of us have worked most of our life. And then you get to the end of your life and then you die. And then the question is, who gets your stuff? But you probably haven't thought of that far ahead if you're still going up the ladder. But one day you'll discover that your ladder was against the wrong building anyway. And you'll say, oh, there's really more to life than this. And it usually happens for a guy somewhere between 45 and 50. His buddy falls over dead, and then he goes, is this it? I mean, some of you saw City Slickers with a bit of crystal where he's looking in the mirror, and he just turned 40, and he's like, this is as good as it's going to get, and it's not going to ever get any better. And it kind of like dawns on him one day, oh, I'm mortal. Well, that doesn't occur to you till somewhere in the 40s there. Usually, unless you've got great spiritual perception, which most guys don't get till they're 40. So Jesus got it at 30. So anyway, 2:18 Ecclesiastes. If you want to get a wisdom quick, Ecclesiastes is a book to depress you.
And it basically, the bottom line comes out, if you don't serve the Lord, you've wasted your life.
And chapter 12 is what I call the old people's manual. The windows start to shut, but your eyes don't work anymore, and you can't hear the maidens sing anymore. Your ears are now getting hearing aids, and your arms start to droop, and you hunch over when you walk, and you're afraid of the street because there's bandits on the street. They'll come beat you up, and then your capybara fails. Well, that's not good. Well, when your capybara fails, that's not a good thing. That's why they got Viagra today, to fix capybaras. All the diseases in the whole world we could fix, we fixed that. Go figure. Anyway, so here's what he's saying about his work in verse 18, and I put this in the context with Rehoboam following him. 2:18, he says, "Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun," that means under the heavens, "for I must leave it to a man who will come after me." And Solomon was a workaholic, okay? A workaholic is not good. You have a mistress, it's called work. And just a clue for those who are listening and some of those who are here, your kids are going to bury you. You might want to be nice to them and know them. Because the rest of us love you, but c'est la vie, baby. We'll come to your service, maybe, if we got time that afternoon. We don't have to be with the grandchildren or at the diabetes place, we'll come.
You think I'm kidding, don't you? Silly people. So, verse 19, "Who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun." This too is a vapor.
Okay, back to Rehoboam. Now, we've got the tension here between Rehoboam and Jeroboam. And I want to come back and find my charts of the kings here. You have this one. It's just three pages of this, but we're going to start with this one. Solomon dies here. Rehoboam is going to be in the south, and Jeroboam will be in the north. Two tribes go south, one tribe, 10 tribes go north. And so we're looking at his son Rehoboam in chapter 12, where the kingdom divides. Remember, divides over what? Taxes. Not that that would ever cause any kind of division anywhere. 21 hours, huh? Verse 12, chapter 12, verse 1. "Then Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had come to Shechem to make him king. Now when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard about it," he was living in Egypt, for he was in Egypt, where he had fled from the presence of Solomon, "and they sent and called him, and Jeroboam and all the assembly of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, saying, 'Your father made our yoke hard.'" Remember, Jeroboam had been over the forced laborers. Okay? So he knows what it is to be the slave master, taskmaster.
And he says, he made it hard for us. And your father put a heavy yoke on us, which he put on us. And, verse 4. "Your father made our yoke hard, therefore lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke, which he put on us, and we will serve you."
So he's just simply saying, back off a little bit and the people will serve you.
"Then he," that's Rehoboam, "said to them, 'Depart from me for 3 days and then return.' So the people departed." So Jeroboam doesn't force the issue at this point. He's already had a Ahijah's prophecy. He's going to allow the events to work their way out. You don't have to force the will of God.
You can trust God with it to work it out. Now you have to trust God with it, but not work it out yourself sometimes. Because sometimes we'd like to fix things for God. Not that you would ever do that.
We like to help him because he's just fortunate to have us on his side, right? I'm like that. Hi-ho. So, anyway, here we go. Then, verse 6, "Then King Rehoboam consulted with the elders who had served his father while he was still alive, saying, 'How do you counsel me to answer the people?' And they spoke to him, saying, 'If you will be a servant to this people today, they will serve them, grant them their petition, and speak good words to them, they will be your servants forever.'"
So what do the elders suggest? Back up a little bit. Don't tax them so much. They'll follow you. It's not like you didn't need the money. I mean, the money's, you've got all the money in the world.
So now he's going to, says verse 8, but he forsook, he abandoned the counsel of the elders, which they had given him, and he consulted with the young men who grew up with him and served him. Well, I'm sure this just is a nifty group of wise men. Yeah. Okay, so he says to them, what do you counsel? That we may answer this people who have spoken to me. Lighten up the yoke and put your, which your father put on us. And he spoke to, and the young men who grew up with him spoke to him. Thus you shall say to the people who spoke to you, saying, your father made our yoke heavy. Now you make it lighter for us. But you shall speak to them, my father's little finger is thicker than my father's loins. Well, that's not a compliment, okay? You can figure out what a loin is, and you can figure out what a little finger is. So he's dissing his father. Whereas my father loaded you with a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions or akrabim. And these are
multi-end whips with barbed points and sticks on them. It's balls. They sting when they hit you. It's like that girl my mother threw at me that time.
So this one was a whip. So Jeroboam comes to the people, and they returned on the third day.
He answered the people harshly or roughly.
Shocking is how he answered them. He forsook the advice of the elders, and he spoke to them according to the advice of the young men. My father made your yoke heavy, but I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. So the king did not listen to the people, for it was a turn from the Lord, or a movement from the Lord. May he establish his word which he had spoken to Ahijah the Shilonite, to Jeroboam the son of Nebat. So Solomon's oppressive rule, but guess what? I'm going to respond harder. I'm going to respond twice as hard here. So verse 16, when all Israel saw what the king did,
listen, the people answered the king saying, what portion do we have in David?
We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Now look after your own house, David. So Israel departed to their tents. So the kingdom is now divided in half. Solomon, Rehoboam, Solomon's son, is a fool who follows him with all the work that Solomon did. He ended up giving it to a fool. No wisdom in it all.
I will tribute most of my early success in ministry to three older pastors. And I'd gone through the academic thing. I'd done the academics and did that well. I'd been in the corporate world before I went to seminary, so I had some idea what I was looking for. I wanted more Bible so I could explain the Old Testament. I'm still working on that. But I ran out of degrees.
So you can't stay here anymore. You've run out of degrees. You've got to go. Can't we work on the Old Testament some more? Well, you can, but we don't have any diplomas for you. So I graduated in 84 from Dallas Seminary and went to Victoria to a church of 35, 40 people at the time. Dynamic, we're going global kind of thing, you know. And my classmates all said, why in the world did you get all this education to go be in Victoria? And I said, that is a really good question. We should ask the Lord that question. Because they were like, why are you just going to this little inky-dinky-rink church? And I said, I don't know, but my wife and I believe that's where God wants us. So I figured it's probably a good thing to do. So we went to Victoria, and of course, just like most ministries that you touch and turn to gold, this one did. And it grew to a whole 140 in 6 years. Of course, if you're counting percentages, that's up about 700 or 800%. You know, go to meet other pastors and go, well, we had 47 extra baptisms this year. And I go, well, we're up 4%. We're up 10%. We're up 100%.
We did two from last year, not one. So we're now up 100% from last year. So you just go to percentages. You don't use the numbers because small church can't compete with those kind of guys. So I went to these older guys and I said, you know, I want your wisdom in how to walk with the Lord and be a good shepherd. And the three of them told me, three of these great men, they said, call us day or night and we'll give you our name.
And one of them in particular, Don in particular, was so good because I could call him in, it'd be 2 in the morning, he'd be fine. He'd say, hey, Kim. And you know what he would say to me immediately? Give me 3 good things that are going on. I'd say, what? Before you tell me the problem, give me 3 good things that God is doing around you. And all of a sudden I backed up,
and the problem that you become myopic about backs away, and you're kind of like, oh, there are some good things going on here. okay, here's what I'm thinking about. He goes, what are you going to do? And I'd tell him, this is what I think we ought to do. He goes, well, if you do that, you should get your resume ready. I said, really? He says, yeah, you're a young pastor. That's what young pastors want to do. Here's what you need to do. And so he would give me wisdom. One guy in particular,
his wife and I had been chasing him for 2 years to get him back to church. We've been praying for God's discipline and all these things, and finally God broke him. And it wasn't through his businesses, it was through his daughter ran away from home, and they couldn't find her, and he called me to come over to his house. And I called Don. I said, I think we finally got him now. I'm going to go over there and read the riot act to him about getting back in church. He says, well, if you do that, you'll lose him forever. But if you just go over to his house and cry with him, you'll have him forever. So guess what I chose? I chose the older man's wisdom. And we went there and sat there for 2 days with him while the police looked for him. And finally they found the daughter and she returned and he came to church after that. My, oh my, strange how wisdom works. So it's the application of it. And so we need to listen. When there's somebody in the room that's smarter than you, listen and see if you can learn from them. This room is full of huge amounts of wisdom. Many of you have been through things in life none of us would even imagine or could imagine. And God has sustained you and helped you. And you're more than glad to share it if somebody would just ask you about it. Now, you don't want to beat them to death with it, but you want to balance that out. But it makes sense to me if somebody's been through something and knows how it works, why not ask them? There's no need to reinvent the wheel, is there? So I attribute, really, most of the things I was going to do those first 2 or 3 years of ministry, I would have blown things up. And it's just the natural tendency of you. And Rehoboam had an opportunity here, didn't he? He could have united the whole kingdom. He'd come out as a whole lot better man with being a great king. Instead, he chose to listen to the fools around him.
Just make sure you choose wise counsel. Just choose wise counsel. So, Israel departs.
They turn, they sent away, they make Jeroboam king over Judah, over Israel, and none of the tribe of Judah follow the house of David in verse 20. And then, verse 25, Jeroboam built Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim, and he lived there, and he went out from there and built Penuel. So he's two, has a lot of capitals. Tirzah will be one of his capitals. Shechem will be one of his capitals. Penuel will be probably his one side of the capital there. And so he builds two. In verse 26, Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom will return to the house of David. If the people go up to offer sacrifices to the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, and the heart of the people will return to the Lord, even to Rehoboam, the king of Judah, and they will kill me and return to Rehoboam.
So Jeroboam is pretty smart cookie here. What does he recognize will happen if the people are returned to Jerusalem, to Solomon's temple, to worship? What's going to happen to them?
They're going to lose them. So here's what he does. This is pretty smart on his behalf. Okay, Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea, Jerusalem's here, kingdom splits about like this. This becomes Judah, and this becomes Israel. So there'll be 10 tribes here, 2 tribes here, Judah and Benjamin. Benjamin is a small tribe. So what Rehoboam's going to do, he's going to go up here to Dan in the north and to Bethel. And he's going to set up places of worship. There's a ridge route here. Runs up this way. Comes up here to Megiddo. Hit the coastline. We've got some things going on there. But he knows that if the people go back here to Jerusalem, that they're going to end up wanting to build houses along this area. They're going to want to stay closer to here because that's where they worship. So being the guy, smart guy he is, here at Bethel, and Dan, he sets up places of worship, so he makes it easier for them to worship. And they don't have to leave the northern kingdom. Because Jeroboam recognizes a principle where the people worship is where their heart is.
I would even venture so far to say what a nation worships is where its heart is. And when the heart of a nation is removed,
or a moral compass, then you're in for a really rough ride. And he figured it out. That's pretty smart.
So he even goes all the way back to Egypt. This is so interesting to me in the Old Testament. I just found all kinds of things interesting here. I guess you recognize that. But look at verse 20. So the king consulted. He made two golden calves, and he said to them, "It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem." We don't want you to have to go all the way up to Jerusalem. You have to go uphill to get there, Mount Zion. It's hot. It's sweaty. We're going to put cable cars up, and we're going to set them up in Bethel and Dan. No, they didn't have cable cars, but they would have if they could have.
And so he says, "It's too hard to go there. Behold, your gods, O Israel, that you brought up from the land of Egypt."
The golden calves of Egypt he sets up. This is what the people like to worship. They love golden calves. Every time these golden calves show up, Israel goes gaga over them. It's like, yeah, golden calf. Oh, gotta worship. And I've been to Dan 5 or 6 times. The gold calves aren't there anymore. Somebody stole them. They're long gone. It's just an empty temple area. I was like, "Where are the golden calves? I came here to see the golden calves." And I said, "The golden calves left a long time ago." Like, hey.
And so he said, "If one in Bethel and the other in Dan, Jacob's worship center, that's where God spoke to him in Genesis 28 in Bethel before he left the land. Jonathan was a grandson of Moses. The northern extremity worshiped in the north. So he's made it easy for him. Now this thing became a sin for the people went to worship there as far as Dan. And he made houses on the high places, verse 31, and he made priests from among the peoples who were not from the sons of Levi. And Jeroboam instituted a feast in the 8th month." So he set up their own feast tables. He set up their own priesthood, not out of the Levites. So anybody could be a priest now. Join the ministry. Come along, everybody. Let's just join up. Get the call. Go be a priest. Verse 33, "Then he went up to the altar which he made at Bethel on the 15th day in the 8th month. In the 11th month, which he had devised in his own heart, he instituted a feast for the sons of Israel
and went up to burn an altar of incense." Wow.
So, he ends up worshiping in this place. And now in chapter 13, we have another prophet coming to speak to him. "Now behold, there came a man of God from Judah to Bethel by the word of the Lord, while Jeroboam was standing by the altar. He cried against the altar by the word of the Lord, 'O altar, thus says the Lord, behold, a son shall be born in the house of David, Josiah by his name.'" So he's going to be a unique prophecy here. "And on he shall sacrifice the priest in high places and burn incense, and the bones shall be burned out. And then he gave him a sign that day, saying, 'This is which the Lord has spoken. Behold, the altar will be split in two, and the ashes which are on it will be poured out.' And so when it came about, the king heard the saying of God, he cried out against the altar in Bethel, and Jeroboam stretched out his hand from the altar, saying, 'Seize him.' But his hand stretched out against him, it dried up so that he could not draw it back to himself."
Don't mess with these real priests. They'll mess with you. His hand withers right in front of him. Just tries to grab the priest and we're talking wicked gift of the west kind of wither here.
"So the altar was split apart and the ashes were poured out from the altar according to the sign of the man of God. And the king answered and said, 'O man of God, please, I entreat you, the Lord your God, pray for me that my hand may be restored.' And the man of God entreated the Lord, and the king's hand was restored, and it became as it was before."
So we've got some true prophets in the land. And they come and warn that there's going to be one named Josiah to come, which will be one of the good kings in the south.
So in 14, we get Rehoboam ruling in Judah.
I don't think I'm going to stop there. But I just want to make a note. In 14:25, it came about in the 5th year of Rehoboam, Shishak, the king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem. So 9:25, Shishak will come in and invade the country. He'll capture 156 cities and Judah, Edom, and Philistia. And there is an inscription on Aaron's in Ammon's temple in Karnak of Egypt of this battle, what took place there. And so Rehoboam, verse 31, sleeps with his fathers and he's buried. Now we pick up another king here.
along the way, Abijam. It's going to be right up here on the chart. Not terribly long.
It's going to rule about eight verses. So, chapter 15, Abijam becomes king over Judah. He reigned 3 years, and his mother's name was Maachah, and the daughter of Absalom, or Absalom. And he walked in all the sins of his father which he had committed, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord like the heart of his father David. But for David's sake, God gave him a lamp in Jerusalem to raise his son after him to establish Jerusalem. So it's a picture of a generation being allowed to live. That's with the lamp being lit. And verse 8, Abijam slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David, and Asa his son became king in his place. Now Asa follows him here, you'll see on the chart, is got a checkmark with him. He's one of the good kings. So in the 20th year, chapter 15, verse 9, Asa began to reign as king of Judah. He reigned 41 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Maachah, and the daughter of Absalom. And Asa did what was right in the sight of the Lord, like his father David. So he gets rid of some of the idols, and starts with a 10-year rule of peace. And verse 14, it says, the high places were not taken away. Nevertheless, the heart of Asa was wholly devoted to the Lord all his days. So the high places are still there, but he's devoted to the Lord. So again, we still got that compromise going on, don't we? Must be something inherent with all of us that we'd like to tend to compromise on things. Would that be an observation you would note about other people? Or you have a friend who compromises? Something like that? The one in the mirror that you're talking to there? So verse 16, now there was war between Asa and Baasha, the king of Israel, all their days. So now we see, we didn't talk about Nadab, but we're talking about Baasha here. So Baasha in the north and Asa in the south, these guys are going to do battle with each other. And I want to get right here to this one tonight. So let's move on down a little bit here. I'm not going to talk much about Baasha. I want to pick it up in verse 8 of chapter 16. In the 26th year of Asa, the king of Judah, Elah, the son of Baasha, became king over Israel in Tirzah and reigned 2 years. And his servant Zimri, commander of half his chariots, conspired against him. Now he was at Tirzah drinking himself drunk in the house of Arza, who was over the household of Tirzah. Arza at Tirzah, drinking him drunk. These are funny words. Then Zimri went in and struck him and put him to death on the 27th year of Asa, the king of Judah, and became king in his place. So it came about, as he became king, as soon as he sat on his throne, he killed all the household of Baasha, did not leave a single male, neither relatives nor friends. Thus Zimri destroyed the household of Baasha. Of course, again, we're talking about over here in the northern kingdom, right here, Zimri. Now, he's not going to be around terribly long. He says, verse 13, for all the sins Baasha and the sons of Elah, his son, which they sinned, they made Israel sin, provoking the God of anger, God of Israel to anger with their idols. And so here's a really cool one. And then we're going to get into a really, really cool one next week. But we got to do get past these guys to get there. So verse 15, we're going to meet the reign of Zimri. This will be the shortest reign of any Israelite king in the north. In the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, Zimri reigned 7 days at Tirzah. No, not a long rule, but it's quality, not quantity. Right? Now, the people who camped against Gibbethon, which belonged to the Philistines, and the people who camped heard it, Zimri has conspired and has struck down the king. Therefore, all the Israel made Omri the commander of the army, king over Israel that day in the camp. So now we have a coup d'etat going on. The military is now not going to bow to Zimri. They're going to bow to who? Omri, because he's the general that they like. Verse 17, then Omri and all Israel with him went out from Gibbethon, and they besieged Tirzah. That's one of the key capital cities. Came about when Zimri saw that the city was taken, that he went into the citadel of the king's house and burned the king's house over him with fire, and he died. This has got to be the dumbest of all the kings in the north. If you're going to commit suicide, I think burning a house on top of yourself is about the dumbest way to go. I can think of ways to be a lot quicker than, oh, I'm going to go set my house on fire and lie down here until it falls in on me. This is probably not a bright person here. But needless to say, he only had 7 day rule, so
you say about the easy memory.
So verse 21, the people of Israel were divided two parts, and half of the people followed Tibni, and the other the son of Ginnath, to make him king, and the other half followed Imri. And the people who followed Imri prevailed over the people who followed Tibni and the son of Ginnath, and Tibni died, and Omri became king.
Now, it's not stated here,
but it's certainly suggested in between the lines, and I want to be careful about that because I don't read between lines. But Tibni was probably executed by somebody in Omri's army here, because we're talking about soldiers and coup d'etats. So in the 31st year of Asa, king of Judah, Omri became king over Israel, and he reigned 12 years. He reigned at Tirzah. He brought the hill of Samaria from Shemar for 2 talents of silver, and he built on the hill a city which he called Samaria after the name Shemar, the owner of the hill.
So Samaria now becomes the northern king's capital.
And Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord. He acted more wickedly than all who were before him, for he walked in the ways of Jeroboam the son of Nebat and his sins, which he made Israel sin.
That's the golden calves again.
The golden calves are going to keep showing up again. Now the rest of the acts of Omri, which he did, and his might, are written in the book of Chronicles and the kings of Israel. So Omri
slept with his father and is buried in Samaria.
Okay, now watch this shift. And Ahab, his son, became king in his place.
Oh, this is where the kings start cooking. I know, you've been very patient. Okay, you've been patient with me. But trust me, you do not want to miss the next few weeks. Because we are going to meet Ahab, and remember his wife?
Jezebel.
And Elijah will show up, and Jehoshaphat will show up, and these two are going to go into battle together. This is really good. They decide to go into battle against Syria together, Ahab and Jehoshaphat, northern kingdom, southern kingdom line, to protect themselves from the Syrians. Jehoshaphat can't be the brightest star in the galaxy either. Because as they go into battle, Ahab says, here, you wear the royal colored garment. And Jehoshaphat, well, thank you. So he gets in his chariot and he starts wearing these garments and he's riding through the battle. And they're all, and you'll see there are, it says, thus, they have SEAL teams assigned in battle only to find the king and kill him. That's their only mission. They're not to fight in the rest of the battle. They say the archers are to find the king and kill him. That's their task. And so even back then they had military strategies. And so this particular group of archers, they're looking for Ahab. But they see this guy riding around in brightly colored clothes. And they go, there he goes. And they're like, oh, let's get him. And Jehoshaphat's like, whoa, they see me. And so anyway, he's going on down the road. This is so good. And then Jezebel, Elijah meets the prophets of Baal and comes down. One woman puts the evil out and he's out of there, man. It's just, oh, that's next week. Okay, well. So let's just take a look here. Verse 29, Ahab the son of Omri became king over the 38th year of Asa. He reigned over Israel and Samaria 22 years, and Ahab the son of Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. We're starting to stack up quite a few bad people here. So it came about, it was a trivial thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. That means the golden calf worship is nothing compared to this. That he married Jezebel,
the daughter of Ethbaal, the king of the Sidonians, who went to serve Baal and worship him.
So he marries Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, the king of the Sidonians. Ethbaal was a priest, according to Josephus, of Ashtoreth. He murdered his successor to the throne, one of Hiram's descendants in Sidon or Phoenicia. He'll have a 32-year rule. And Jezebel's, the root of her name is literally, where is the dung? Or the poo-poo. That's the root of her name. I guess her folks did not like her. So anyway, she's not going to be a nice person. And so Ahab erects an altar for Baal in the house of Baal he built in Samaria, and Ahab also made the Asherah. Thus Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel than all the kings of Israel who were before him. In the days of Hiel, the Bethelite built Jericho. Now back in Joshua 6:26, after the city was destroyed, Jericho was destroyed, they were told them, don't rebuild it or it'll cost you your firstborn. So here we are years later. And so he lays its foundation with the loss of Abiram, his firstborn son. He set up his gates with the loss of his youngest son, Segub. And according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke to Joshua, who was the son of a nun, and nobody's been able to figure that out since. So. Oh, that's not a nun, it's just nun, isn't it? Okay, then just like, I'm going to leave it here, we'll leave it like lightning on a summer's evening when the sky pitch black and all of a sudden you just see a crack in the sky and the lightning flashes across. It says, now Elijah the Tishbite. Okay, we'll hold it there and I'll take questions at this point.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's lesson and encourage you to visit Grace Rock Ministries website at www.gracerockministries.org. Our website provides a variety of material to communicate the unchanging truths of God's Word, the Bible. While at the website, please consider donating in support of Grace Rock Ministries. Your donation helps us continue to get God's good news to our podcast listeners. Once again, that's www.gracerockministries.org. Thanks.